Robert Stark. I am joined here with Keith Preston. We're going to be discussing some of the topics going on in the Middle East involving Russia, Iran. Later on, we'll also be discussing the elections and Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. Keith Preston, it is great having you back on the show.
Thanks, Robert. Thanks for having me back.
So you've done a number of media appearances with Iranian Press TV, and the
yes.
topic was about Russia's role in the situation in Syria. Also, was it about, did you talk also the Iran deal that is in the Senate right now?
Well, I've actually done quite a bit of work with Press TV, which is Iran's television network. And yeah, I've appeared on that network quite a bit discussing Middle Eastern politics, including the Iran deal, including Russia's role in the Middle East.
Are they out of Iran, or do they have a Western branch?
Well, they're out of Iran. Normally when I do an interview with them, the people that I'm speaking with are actually in Tehran. I've done television and radio interviews with them. And Press TV is it's similar to public television and public radio in the United States. Just like we have PBS and NPR, they have Press TV. That's sort of their equivalent of the public television. But I've been on I've actually recorded live on-camera footage interviews for them, as well as done audio interviews. But they are based in Iran. Whenever I speak with journalists from that network, they're usually based in Iran.
So we can talk about the Iran deal first. And there's a lot of different theories going around about that deal. Some people think that Obama is being independent of the agendas being put out. There's other theories that he has ulterior motives. What is your personal take on that Iran deal?
Well, it's pretty complicated, but there's a number of different factors that come into play. First of all, as everyone knows, there's been a sanctions imposed on Iran by the United States. It's going back to the Iranian Revolution in 1979, and there've been other sanctions imposed on Iran as well, largely over Iran's alleged nuclear program. As the United States has always been at the forefront of trying to maintain this sanctions system, and what has happened is that Iran has actually undertaken a number of peace initiatives towards the United States, and what they've done is they've actually bypassed the political class. They've actually bypassed normal diplomatic channels and engaged in direct outreach largely to the business class in the United States, because the lifting of sanctions against Iran would be an enormous opportunity for a lot of business interests in the United States in terms of trade and investment. Iran is potentially a very rich and prosperous nation. However, the sanctions have had a very crippling effect on the Iranian economy. Iran actually undertook a peace initiative largely by reaching out directly to the business class in many ways. And what I think we are seeing going on in the American government is something of a split emerging between different factions of the political class. On one hand, we have the more hawkish, Republican-oriented sectors under the leadership of the neocons who not only want to maintain the present situation with the sanctions and so forth, but they want to rescind the Iran deal that's being put into place. And I think if the neoconservatives were still in power running the State Department and the Defense Department, we would probably be at war with Iran by now. I think because the longstanding agenda that the neocons have has been to eliminate any independent nations in the Middle East that stand in the way of American imperialism and stand in the way of Israeli expansionism. And Iran has always been foremost in their sights. In fact, I think the Iraq War in 2003 was really just a prelude in many ways for what they were hoping to eventually do in Iran. But I think, though, that there are other factions of the American political establishment who don't want to have a repeat of the war in Iraq, who realized what a disaster that was, not only for Iraq, but for the United States also. And that combined with the failure of the war in Afghanistan, I think it's made a lot of people in the American political class a bit hesitant to engage in further wars in the Middle East. So for this reason, I think we're starting to see the more moderate wing of the American foreign policy establishment trying to advocate for a less hawkish point of view than what would be the case if the neocons were still holding power.
Yeah, there's definitely a perception among political dissidents, and especially the conspiracy theory-minded, that the elites are all in cahoots with each other and that they are monolithic in their opinion, and that everything they do serves some secretive hidden agenda. But that's not necessarily the case. There are issues where there is conflict between different issues. One example is there's sort of a perception that corporations always want war, but in a lot of cases I think corporations in a lot of cases would benefit from opening up Iran economically, so they could fill Iran up with U.S. corporations and have more access to their oil. One example is on the issue of China. There's some within the there's those in U.S. foreign policy who see China as a threat to American hegemony, but then you have a lot of business interests that are invested in outsourcing manufacturing jobs to China. So within the American establishment, there's not a total uniformity. I think that's important to point out because a lot of people don't get that.
Well, yeah, I think you're absolutely right about that. I think that the within the Republican Party, what you have is a fairly very hawkish form of quasi-nationalism that's all about American imperialism and hegemonic domination of other parts of the world, period. And I think that comes in many ways before any particular set of business interests. I think they're about empire first and business second. And, of course, the neocons, being Israeli nationalists, are drawn to that because they see that as serving the interest of Israel, at least as far as Middle Eastern policy is concerned. Now, you do have a wide spectrum of other business interests in the United States that aren't necessarily that don't necessarily have this outlook, that are more interested in expanding the global economy, and they see persistent war between the United States and other nations, a persistent conflict between the United States and other nations, as getting in the way of business. So you do have that kind of conflict between the business sectors, a substantial segment of the business class, and the military-industrial complex and the foreign policy establishment and the more nationalist, imperialist-oriented sectors of the elite. And we're even starting to see some shifts now when it comes to Israel as well. For a long time, the United States simply backed up anything Israel ever did, and the American political class was united on that. And the Israel lobby in the United States was arguably the most powerful, or certainly one of the most powerful lobbies in the U.S. Congress, for example. We've actually started to see that crack up a little bit recently. For one thing, the pro-Israel sectors in the U.S. are a lot less monolithic than they once were. There was a liberal or a more centrist, I guess you could say more centrist, Israel lobby that was started a few years ago by George Soros in opposition to AIPAC. It's called J Street. And then there's a more left-wing group now called Jewish Forces for Peace, which it takes a far less hawkish point of view than either of the other two. So we're starting to see a shift among Jewish opinion in the United States and among pro-Israel sectors in the United States concerning even the issue of Israel. And I think we see that creeping into the political class also, because no previous U.S. president would have rebuffed Benjamin Netanyahu the way Obama has done. So we do see that the influence of Israel in the United States is starting to crack a bit. And I think it's because there are sectors of the American business class and the American political establishment as well, who increasingly view Israel as a liability.
I was actually really surprised by the large numbers of traditionally sort of like pro-Israel Jewish Democrats who are voting for the Iran bill. There's a few of them opposing it, like Chuck Schumer, but large numbers of them are supporting the Iran deal.
Well, what's interesting is that if you look at polls that have been done on that, Jewish Americans actually are further left on issues like that than non-Jewish Americans. which makes sense up to a point, because Jews tend to trend leftward in their political opinions anyway. Although a lot of American Jews have always shifted over to the right when it comes to Israel, but that's apparently fading. I think particularly among younger Jewish people.
What exactly does the Iran deal do? A lot of people are talking about it, and there's all these different allegations about it. Does it just lift sanctions? Some of the Republicans are saying that we're actually giving them all this money and weapons. I mean, what is the Iran deal, and what does it imply?
Well,
what does it entail?
A quick Google search can dispel some of that. It's not hard to find out information about the Iran deal online. But to break it down a bit, and without getting into a lot of technical issues regarding the technology and so forth that's involved, the deal is that Iran will reduce its nuclear production capacities below the level that is necessary to acquire nuclear weapons. In other words, according to the deal, Iran will not be allowed to have nuclear production capabilities that of the kind that would be necessary in order to actually build a bomb. However, they can engage in nuclear research and production for other purposes, like, for example, nuclear power and things like that. In return, the sanctions will be lifted, and Iran has agreed to inspections. Whenever international disarmament experts consider Iran to be potentially building nuclear weapons, if allegations like that are made, the inspectors have the right to go actually conduct an inspection within a 24-day period, which is not enough time to build a weapon and move it and things like that. So it's a pretty intense inspection system. It's not just a giveaway inspection system at all, like some of the more hawkish sectors are claiming.
Is part of the reason of the deal, does this have to do with Iran's role in opposing ISIS? Is that a factor?
Well, I don't think that's the case. I think that we simply have sectors in the American government who don't want war with Iran, who have, you know, I think, for example, there are people in the State Department, in the Obama administration, who see what a disaster the war in Iraq was, and they see what a disaster the war in Afghanistan was, and they know that selling another war to the American public would be difficult. They know that a war with Iran would be much worse than the war with Iraq. If the Iraq war turned out badly for the United States, and a war in Iran would likely turn out much worse. So I do think that there are sectors of the American political class who really do want to avoid a war with Iran. As far as the role of Iran in Middle Eastern politics, it's true that Iran is opposed to ISIS, and it's possible that the United States may see, or at least sectors within the American foreign policy establishment may see ISIS as a potential bulwark. I mean, may see Iran as a potential bulwark against ISIS. Because the standard mode of operation that the United States has normally employed in Middle Eastern politics is to play different ends against one another. And in fact, I was actually discussing this with Press TV recently as well. If we look at the whole history of American foreign policy in the Middle East, we see there's always an effort to try to play different groups off against one another. The United States, for example, supported the Mujahideen against the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan. And the United States has always sided with this radical Islamic fundamentalist in the Middle East against secular Arab nationalism. The main thing that the United States has always tried to prevent in the Middle East is the rise of a type of secular Arab nationalism of the kind that was represented by leaders like, say, Nasser and people like that, because that's the type of Arab nationalism that is most likely to resist American imperialism and hegemony in the Middle East, and that's the last thing they want. It's a lot, in their view, it's easier to work with Islamic fundamentalists than to work with secular Arab nationalists, and that's why they've always had it in for the Ba'athists, they've always had it in for the Nasserites, they always had it in for Gaddafi and people like that. At the same time, what normally happens is that, and this has happened repeatedly, the United States has aligned itself with Islamic fundamentalists only to have it blow up in their face. That's what happened in Afghanistan in the 80s when the Russians left and all of these Mujahideen groups started proliferating into the terrorist groups like the Al-Qaeda and groups of that nature. And this is still a strategy that the United States is trying to pursue. In fact, just recently I saw where David Petraeus came out and said that the United States should now back Al-Qaeda in its war with ISIS, because ISIS and Al-Qaeda are now in conflict. So this is the kind of logic that the American foreign policy establishment has used as far as its Middle East policy for decades now, and this is the kind of results you get. So there may be some thinking along those lines that Iran is possibly a bulwark against ISIS or against some of the more radical Islamic forms of Islamic fundamentalism. Also, I think there are business interests in the United States that have influence that want to do business with Iran. I think there are other interests that don't want a war, you know, elite interests that don't want to have a war with Iran. At the same time, the other side of it is I think the real issue the neocons and a lot of the hawkish sectors have with Iran is, yeah, they keep throwing up about how Iran's going to get the bomb anyway and they're going to do all these awful things. I don't think that's really what they're worried about. I think that that's just a smokescreen issue they're raising. What they really don't want is for there to be an independent and prosperous Iran, because they think that an independent and prosperous Iran will be a leading force in the Middle East that resists Western imperialism, and in particular, Iran will not only be a strong Middle Eastern nation that's independent, but they'll also provide support to the Assad regime in Syria. They will continue to provide support to Hezbollah, to enemies of Israel, to enemies of Saudi Arabia, and I think that that's what the right wing of the American political establishment is really concerned about, it's particularly now that Iran has emerged as the leader of the resistance bloc. The resistance bloc is a coalition of Iran, the Syrian government of Assad, Hezbollah, and a number of Palestinian and Iraqi and Yemenite groups that are, on one hand, they're anti-American, anti-Israel, anti-Saudi. They're also against the Islamic fundamentalist terrorist insurgent movements that you find in that region, like ISIS and like Al-Qaeda. And I think that Iran's role as a leader in the resistance bloc is one of the real issues that the neocons have with them.
So when the neocons say that Iran is planning on nuking Israel, that's utter nonsense.
Yeah, well, there's no case for that at all. For one thing, there's no evidence that Iran has ever even tried to develop a nuclear weapon. Iran has long had a nuclear program of the kind that would be oriented towards the cultivation of things like nuclear power, but there's no evidence that Iran has ever actually even had a nuclear program, and international armaments experts actually agree with that. What the issue is the potential of Iran developing a nuclear weapons program. The other issue is that the Ayatollah Khomeini, who was the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, actually issued a fatwa banning the development of nuclear weapons. He believed it was counter to Islamic law. He wasn't the most liberal guy, but he was opposed to Iran developing nuclear weapons. There's the evidence that Iran has ever had the ambition to obtain nuclear weapons is scant. So I don't think that's the real issue at all. I don't think that that's what the neocons are worried about. I think that's a smokescreen issue.
So the other thing you've been discussing on Press TV is the role that Russia is playing. And so right now Russia is actually sending in military to Syria to assist the Assad regime against ISIS. And it's putting the American, the hawkish element of the American establishment in an awkward situation, because on one hand, Russia is doing a good thing fighting against ISIS, but they see this as a major threat to American hegemony, because if Russia is successful, that would greatly weaken the influence of the United States.
Yeah, and that's a big issue for the American foreign policy establishment. It's one of the main things that they want to achieve in the Middle East, aside from maintaining American hegemony and supporting Israel and supporting Saudi Arabia, is they also want to prevent Russia and China from having any influence in the region. Russia, on the other hand, looks at it like the Middle East is part of their legitimate sphere of influence, particularly Central Asia. Many of the Central Asian nations, of course, were part of the Soviet Union, and before that they were part of the Russian Empire. And Russia has always, for centuries, looked at it like their legitimate sphere of influence is Central Asia and Eastern Europe. And they're not going to back away from that. And the Putin government in Russia, it has a very traditional Russian approach to foreign policy, and that's one thing a lot of Americans aren't seeming to get, is that the Russia of Vladimir Putin is not Leonid Brezhnev's Russia, it's not Joseph Stalin's Russia, it's not Lenin's Russia. It's in many ways a return to pre-Lenin Russia, and particularly in foreign policy. Russia has always viewed the Eastern European region as a legitimate sphere of its own influence, in part because that has been the historic invasion route into Russia. If you look at all the times that Russia has been invaded, it's usually come through Eastern Europe. That's how Napoleon invaded Russia. That's how the Allies invaded Russia in World War I. That's how Hitler invaded Russia in 1941. That's a long-standing concern of Russia. In fact, that was one of the reasons why the Soviet Union was so adamant about maintaining hegemony over the Eastern European Warsaw Pact nations during the Cold War. And Russia continues to be adamant about maintaining a sphere of influence in Eastern Europe and in Central Asia. Central Asia is important to them in part because they lack access to a seaport to the south. So they have to be able to have access, in their view, from their geopolitical interest, they have to have access to a warm water port. For example, that was one of the reasons why they invaded Afghanistan in 1979. But it's a reason why they continue to want to have a sphere of influence in Central Asia, in part because they lost so much territory when the Soviet Union collapsed, and also because of the growth of Islamic fundamentalism. They don't want that spreading towards the Russian heartland itself.
Do you think the Russian role in Syria, do you think it will stabilize Syria, or do you think it could provoke a greater conflict? I mean, there's plenty of different scenarios. One scenario is Russian military could get into conflict with a U.S. ally, or one scenario is that ISIS could retaliate against Russia because they have there's a large Muslim population of Chechens within Russia. So there's different scenarios. It could either stabilize the region, or it could lead to another conflict. How do you see things working out?
Well, Russia's main objective, is to see the Assad regime stand, which is an important thing because the Assad regime is one of the primary bulwarks against the spread of Islamic fundamentalism. And I think Russia understands that, and that's one reason why they're supporting Assad. Aside from the fact that Assad is also demands an independent course of development for Syria apart from American hegemony. The fact that Assad is both an anti-American force and an anti-Sunni fundamentalist force is important to Russia, and I think they want to see the Assad regime remain intact because of that, and I think that's why they're intervening on behalf of the Assad regime. Also, I think they're concerned about the spread of Islamic terrorism and Islamic fundamentalist insurgency movements in that part of the world. I don't think they view that as in their geopolitical interest at all. The United States, of course, has expressed objections to Russia's involvement in this for the reasons I just discussed. But Russian involvement in Syria has only just recently begun. It's only really started in the last few weeks. So it's hard to tell where it could go. It could result in terrorist actions being carried out within Russia itself by Islamists. It's going to be interesting to see to what degree the United States considers this a provocation and how the United States attempts to respond to that. You know, American and Russian relations were already strained over Crimea, and also, more importantly, because the United States has tried to extend NATO right up to Russia's border. The United States has tried to encircle Russia and Central Asia with military bases. And Russia in the process is becoming more assertive in Central Asia and now in Syria and also in Eastern Europe. So, you know, there are some people who say it's the return of the Cold War, and I don't really see it that way at all. I think that's a bit of an exaggeration. But we do see things becoming more tense between the United States and Russia. And I think we could see rivalries developing similar to the type that's developing now between America and China. The Chinese are starting to become a little bit more assertive in the South Asian region, and in Southeast Asia and the South China Seas, and it looks like that situation is becoming a little bit tenser as well.
So the big thing in Europe right now is this massive refugee crisis, and a lot of it is basically is tied into foreign policy because in Libya. Gaddafi was removed under Obama, and Gaddafi was keeping stability there, so you have people from all over Africa, North Africa, and Sub-Saharan Africa pouring in through the Libya route. And then you also have a lot of people from Syria and Iraq, but also people are coming as far as Pakistan to get into Europe. I think now Germany is talking about they want to give basically like permanent refugee status to as many as 800,000 people.
Yeah, I think it's certainly true that the refugee issue that we're seeing is an outgrowth of the wars themselves. I think without the wars, that problem wouldn't be there. And it's interesting to see how the Western European countries are taking in refugees, and some elements are calling for taking in even more refugees. But if we contrast that with what the Gulf states are doing, they're not taking any refugees. Saudi Arabia and the other Gulf state monarchies are not taking any refugees. All of the refugees are being taken in by the Europeans.
So those states like Saudi Arabia and Qatar played a major role in fomenting the conflict in Syria.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, the Sunni insurgent movements, these Sunni terrorist groups that we see all over the Middle East, are largely financed by wealthy elements among the Saudi and other Gulf state elites. You know, all throughout the Gulf, you have, you know, the UAR, or UAE, Oman, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia itself, Dubai, and other places of that type. It's the oil money in the Gulf region that funds all of these Sunni terrorist groups. They don't develop on their own. They get plenty of funding from those forces. And in fact, most of the religious extremism that you find in the Middle East, the Islamic religious extremism, comes from Saudi Arabia. That's based on the Wahhabist interpretation of Islam, which is more or less the state religion in Saudi Arabia, and the Saudi ruling class funds and supports the clerics who teach this and who spread it throughout the Middle East. That's where the Taliban came from. The Taliban are not indigenous to Afghanistan. They're an export from Saudi Arabia, as is Al-Qaeda, as is the kind of ideology that you see among ISIS. So it's really, really without the support that this kind of thing gets from the ruling classes of the Gulf monarchies, you wouldn't see these kinds of Sunni fundamentalist terrorist groups having nearly the size or impact that they have. Well, we also have to consider that the United States plays a role in this as well, because the United States is a primary benefactor of the oil monarchies in the Gulf region, and the United States has also long supported these Sunni fundamentalist terrorist groups against secular Arab nationalism.
So why do you think Germany, out of all countries, is being like singled out? Is it a decision by the German government? I mean, what do the German people think? I mean, first of all, Germany is the most prosperous country in Europe. But basically, they're all pouring into Germany, and it's not just the first round. I mean, now people from Iraq are talking about moving to Germany. It's basically like this is one of the biggest disasters in history. It's basically like the novel Camps of the Saints.
Yeah, that was a novel that was written years ago, I guess in the 70s sometime, by Jean Raspail, about a mass invasion of Europe from the Middle East by people on boats and that kind of thing. And some people are making that comparison. But, Yeah, well, we have to consider that it is the wars that have generated the refugee problem. Most of these people are refugees from the war, and the European countries are taking in all of these refugees, and they're doing it in largely for ideological reasons. They look at it like it would be against multicultural values or whatever to refuse them. Now, what I would advocate for, if I were anyone that had any influence, would be, in my view, the West should force its puppet states in the Gulf region to take in these refugees. You know, the United States and Europe should tell the Saudis and the other Gulf states that they are responsible for taking in these refugees. That would ever happen.
Go ahead. The country of Qatar, they're spending $250 billion to host the World Cup, and Al Jazeera is run either by the Qatar government or by a group of billionaires there, but they're constantly running these like sob stories about how Europeans have to feel guilty about all these refugees coming in. I mean, it's really disgusting.
Yeah, and while they're making it like the Europeans have a responsibility to somehow assimilate all of these refugees, while the Gulf states do absolutely nothing. As I said, we could go down the whole list of all the Arab nations in the Gulf, and not a one of them has done anything to assist the refugees. Not Saudi Arabia, not Qatar, not Kuwait, not the UAE, not Dubai. None of them. They're really just trying to put it all off on the Europeans.
You posted an article about Donald Trump's foreign policy, and first of all, with Donald Trump, there's a lot of positive aspects about him. He is talking about issues like immigration, about trade deals, about jobs going overseas. I also saw an article saying a lot of liberals are warming up to Donald Trump on taxes. He made that comment that a hedge fund manager should pay their share in taxes. So on a lot of issues, he is one of the more sensible candidates in comparison to the others. And you could even make sort of a comparison to Ross Perot. But his foreign policy views are totally incoherent. Back in the Bush era, he was very outspoken. He was outspoken. He opposed the war in Iraq from the beginning, and I give him credit for that. He said the war in Iraq was an utter disaster. But now he's kind of his foreign. I mean, I wouldn't say he's definitely not a non-interventionist, but he's definitely pandering to the neocons. He's taking part in a rally against the Iran deal. And then he proposed sending U.S. military into Syria against ISIS. And then taking ISIS's oil from Syria, but he doesn't understand I think a lot of it is just rhetoric and not serious plans. But hypothetically, if you were to do that, you would need to build massive amounts of infrastructure and pipes to carry that oil from that region to a seaport. So that wouldn't work. So there's a lot of, there are a lot of positive things coming out of the Trump campaign, but his foreign policy is totally incoherent.
Yeah, with Donald Trump, as you mentioned, in some ways I see him as a repeat of what happened with Ross Perot in the early 90s. It's a similar situation where you have a guy who is a billionaire, and so he has his own money, and he's able to essentially buy his way into the political process. You know, if Donald Trump was not who he was in terms of his level of wealth and status and fame and so forth, there's no way he would be a viable Republican candidate. There's no way he would have been participating in the Republican debates. He was able to essentially buy his way into the system like Ross Perot was able to do so. And they had somewhat similar views. Trump and Perot both have an economic nationalism is really what guides their economic outlook. They're not Republicans, conventional Republicans who take the whole supply side economic ideology seriously. That's not what Trump is, and that wasn't what Ross Perot is. They're both into economic nationalism. They're in favor of restricted immigration. They're in favor of trade barriers, tariffs, preventing outsourcing, things of that nature. So very much into economic nationalism, or mercantilism is really the proper term for that. And while Ross Perot was something of an isolationist, or at least a non-interventionist on foreign policy, Trump seems to be, as you said, a bit more incoherent on that. On one hand, he's criticized the neocons quite a bit, in the sense that, you know, he had some less than pleasant things to say about John McCain, you know, well-deserved in my view, and he's had some similar things to say about Lindsey Graham. So he's not afraid of criticizing the neocons. And in fact, on Russia, you know, he was saying he didn't really see what the big deal is about Russia's involvement in Crimea and so forth. You know, he pointed out that the European nations don't seem to be that concerned about it. At least, the Western European nations aren't nearly concerned about it. But at the same time, he did criticize the war in Iraq. But then he's called potentially for intervention in Syria. I mean, first of all, the idea of becoming involved in Syria and setting up an oil supply system and so forth would be about as successful as the occupation of Iraq. It's not going to produce happy results. So it's something that shouldn't even be entertained. As far as the Iran deal, I don't know what Trump's coming from on that. For one thing, he doesn't seem very well informed about it. For one thing.
In that interview with Hugh Hewitt, who's he's like a neocon Republican type, and Hugh Hewitt was asking him all these foreign policy questions, and Trump was like, "Yeah, I know, but give me the answer."
Yeah, and I think Trump, on one hand, is probably somewhat sensitive to the fact that if he wants to run for president as a Republican, a lot of Republican voters are very hawkish in foreign policy. So he probably figures he has to cater to that at least to some degree, although a lot of it just seems to be that he hasn't thought out for a lot of this stuff very well. I mean, a lot of the stuff that Trump talks about in terms of foreign policy just doesn't seem very well thought out. It's, it's almost like he hasn't really given it any real study. He's just, basing his opinions on what he sees in the newspaper and things like that. In fact, he even said that he was talking. Someone asked him about the debate that he had. It was before the debate that he had with the other Republican candidates, and they were asking him what kind of preparation he was doing for the debates. And he said, "Oh, I don't think that's necessary. Just go and talk." And so I don't know that he's really prepared an in-depth, well thought out position on any of these things. Except he did issue that position paper on immigration. But his foreign policy views just seem to be a hodgepodge of different ideas that aren't pretty very well thought out and aren't very coherent. And I think that's a shame. A guy like him that had better foreign policy views could go a long way. For example, if he had foreign policy views kind of like, say, Pat Buchanan, or if he was listening to someone like Mike Lashurier or Justin Raimondo, I think that would be great. But that's not happening.
Another thing about the election I've seen is a sort of a death of paleo-libertarianism. There was a movement that it was originally sort of, I think it was founded by Lou Rockwell and Murray Rothbard, and their goal was to combine aspects of libertarianism and like populist conservatism or paleo-conservatism. Ron Paul was definitely sort of, he was definitely in with those guys and he was influenced by them. But what I've noticed is that now with the election, Rand Paul is doing very poorly. He has the support of the libertarians, but most of the paleocon right and people like Buchanan are backing Trump.
Yeah. Rand has not been a very good successor to his father. On one hand, he was the rightful heir in many ways to the Ron Paul legacy, but he hasn't used it very well. If he had just continued to push the same lines that his father always pushed, I actually think he'd be doing better. If he came along as a new younger Ron Paul, I think he'd actually be doing a lot better. Instead, he veered from that, and he has instead tried to brown-nose the Republican Party establishment, brown-nose the neocons, and by doing that, he just comes across as another one of these professional politicians with their scripted answers to every question. He comes
like
across
first,
as just an...
The first thing he did during the debate was when Donald Trump didn't sign the pledge at the time not to run as independent, he's like, "Look at this guy, he's not a real Republican."
Yeah,
Rand Paul Ron Paul ran as being against what the Republican Party was standing for at the time.
Yeah, and Rand has definitely positioned himself as a party man, and I think that's definitely backfired for him. In fact, Trump actually told him that at the debate. He says, "Well, how's that working out for you?" Because what people like about Trump is what they liked about Ron Paul, and what they like about Bernie Sanders, and that is that they are, at least on some level, anti-establishment figures. They're not people that just read a script whenever they're asked a question. Rand Paul doesn't come across any different than Ted Cruz or Marco Rubio or one of these other guys. He's just another scripted Republican actor. And Donald Trump doesn't come across that way. He comes across like a real person. And Sanders does, and Ron Paul did as well. And that's what people are drawn to, the fact that these guys aren't business as usual or don't give the impression of being business as usual.
So you linked to this article, Sanders versus Klein on immigration, the old left against the adolescent left.
Mm-hmm.
This was about an interview that Ezra Klein did with Bernie Sanders. And Klein asked Bernie Sanders about his opinion on immigration, and he made some comment that open borders was a Koch brothers conspiracy.
Yeah, well, Sanders is interesting because he represents the old labor left. He represents the old farm and labor social democratic left, and that's what he has his roots in. And it's interesting because the left wing of the American political spectrum now seems to be splitting up into multiple camps that are easily identifiable. The first is the most mainstream, the most centrist, and that's the neoliberal left, or if it could even be called left, and that's what's represented by Hillary Clinton. And that's the branch of the Democratic Party that is all about accommodating the political and establishment and the economic establishment and the foreign policy establishment, but advancing cultural liberalism, pro-choice and gay rights and affirmative action and open borders immigration and issues of that type. And then Sanders is coming along, and he represents the older populist, social democratic, farm and labor left, where it's more about bread and butter issues. Sanders very much emphasizes economic issues. That's what he's about. He has always, throughout his entire career, as a politician and public figure, and emphasized those kinds of issues, socioeconomic issues, over cultural issues, and over other kinds of issues. And then we have the cultural left, the cultural far left, that's all about left-wing identity politics, where they're not necessarily neoliberals. They're a lot more critical of the establishment than, say, fans of Hillary Clinton would be.
You're talking about, like, the Black Lives Matter movement.
Yeah, that's a good example. That's a good example, or the LGBT movement, or really anything that's, say, to the left of Hillary Clinton but anti-Sanders in the sense of emphasizing cultural politics over economic issues. And this is a branch of the left that has identity politics as its primary area of interest. Although they may, like I said, they may be to the left of say, Hillary on all these other issues as well. And that seems to be a split that's emerging now. For example, there was that incident where the Black Lives Matter people interrupted a Sanders speech or something like that. And we do see that coming out. We do see a split emerging between the economic left and the cultural left.
And it's important, if you look at Sanders' record on immigration, a lot of his rhetoric is good, but there's an organization called Numbers USA, which ranks candidates based on their record, and I think they gave Bernie Sanders an F, and I think Bernie Sanders voted for the amnesty bill, so his actual record on that issue is not the greatest, but I think it's still a step in the right direction that he made that statement. It's very, very rare to hear a prominent person on the left actually say that.
Yeah, it's almost unheard of. In fact, other than Sanders, the only prominent person on the left currently that I know of that has ever said a critical word about immigration as antithetical to the interests of the working class is Ralph Nader. Ralph Nader's made comments of that type before. I'm sure Sanders at least believes that on some basic level. Although Sanders, if you look at his actual track record, he has a history of being fairly consistently far left on economic issues. On social issues and on foreign policy issues, he compromises more. I think that he's definitely an economics man. I mean, to the degree that he has issues that he wants to promote or causes he wants to advance, economics is where it's at from his perspective, which makes sense for somebody like him coming from a type of old left perspective or even an early new left perspective. But so he does seem more willing to compromise on foreign policy issues, on social issues, and other kinds of issues in order to advance economic interests. And I think we would see him doing that if his campaign continues to be popular, if he actually has a shot at beating Hillary for the Democratic nomination, and so forth. I think we would continue to see that happen. I think he would always make economic issues a centerpiece of what he's doing. And I think with other things, he tries to compromise to the degree that he needs to advance the economic issues.
And then you posted this article, Bernie Sanders and His Enemies to the Left. You point out the groups. Oh, is this in reference to his conflict of Black Lives Matter?
Yes, and the fact that the identity politics crowd, the social justice warriors, the politically correct crowd or whatever, they're really attacking Sanders now for being an old white guy who's had less than favorable things to say about immigration and who emphasizes working class issues as opposed to race issues or gay issues or women's issues and things like that. That's the root of that conflict, where the cultural far left has voiced a lot of opposition to Sanders over these kinds of things. You know, they see him as an archaic old leftist where everything's about class and economics, and they don't see it that way. To them, the cultural issues are what matter.
You would describe that the American establishment has become sort of a coalition between economically they're in favor of economically plutocratic, but culturally leftist.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of issues involved in that, but I think what happened, I think we can trace a lot of this back to the late 60s and early 70s, and that is during the cultural upheavals that occurred during that time, I think a lot of establishment figures realized that a way to curb any genuine radicalism in the United States would be to essentially buy off the cultural left. In fact, the Democratic Party had a strategist named Fred Dutton that wrote a book about that as far back as 1970, where he argued that if the Democratic Party wanted to be competitive in the future, that's what they needed to go for, was to try to be less of a working class oriented social democratic populist New Deal Democratic type of party, and instead orient themselves more towards the cultural left. And that happened in 1972 when the new left started taking over the infrastructure of the Democratic Party. And over time, the Democratic Party establishment was essentially able to buy off the cultural left by giving them what they wanted on abortion, on gay rights, on affirmative action, on immigration, on all these other social issues. In exchange, however, the Democratic Party actually started moving rightward on economic issues. In fact, that's where Bill Clinton comes into the picture, because there was a think tank back in the 80s and early 90s, a neoliberal think tank, the Democratic Leadership Council, that in many ways handpicked Bill Clinton as sort of to be their guy, their front guy, for their perspective, which was to move rightward on economic and foreign policy level issues while placating the left with social issues. And that more or less describes what the Democratic Party has done since then. And I think with the ascendancy of the neocons in the Republican Party, the neocons went into the Republican Party in the 70s, and they started working their way into the Reagan administration in the 80s. And by the time of George W. Bush, they'd pretty much taken over the Republican Party. And the neocons are similar in the sense that they have extremely hawkish views on foreign policy, and they're very rightward-leaning on economic issues. At the same time, they're, I wouldn't say left, but liberal on social issues. You know, they don't really care about immigration. They don't really care about gay rights. They don't really care about abortion. They don't really care about racial identity politics or any of that kind of stuff.
What role is the neocons playing in the election? I know Sheldon Adelson is their big financier. Their popularity has diminished, but they still have a lot of influence because of their wealth and access to the media. What role are they playing in the election, especially the Republican primary?
Well, among the Republicans, it's obvious that Jeb Bush is their handpicked candidate. That's the guy that they want for the next president. And then they're grooming some of these others as a standby. I think Cruz and Rubio and even Ben Carson and some others are standbys. For the neocons, I think it's a matter of, we'll back whatever candidate we think can win. We'll groom a whole bunch of guys as our potential candidate and see what we get. We'll throw candidates out there and see what flies. I think Bush is who they want. It's obvious Jeb Bush is who they want. The one of the sons of the first family, so to speak. But if he doesn't work, I think they have others in mind as a backup candidate. The neocons don't really care who their candidate is, as long as he's going to back the American empire, as long as he's going to take a hawkish view on foreign policy and support Israel and things like that. That's what they care about.
Interesting about Trump is actually pandering to the neocons in foreign policy, but a lot of the neocons absolutely despise Donald Trump.
Yeah, and I think that it's because he comes outside the ranks of the Republican establishment. I think that they know he's someone that they're not going to be able to control. And I think that they consider him they had a similar view of Ross Perot as well. They had no use for Ross Perot when he came along. They didn't try to co-opt Ross Perot or get on the Ross Perot bandwagon, because I think they had the same view of him, that he's somebody they weren't going to be able to control either. And they know that's not going to work with Trump. So the neocons want a president whose strings they can pull, and I think they see Jeb Bush as their guy, and some of these others might be a backup plan. Donald Trump is not really a hardcore Republican anyway. I mean, he's actually been a Democrat in the past. He had Hillary come to his wedding. So he's definitely a maverick. I mean, he's very much within the establishment. He is a member of the plutocratic state capitalist class, if anybody is. So he's very much an establishment figure, but he's also a maverick figure within the establishment. He's kind of like the guy who's too rich that he needs to care, basically, and that's why he can say the things that he says. At the Republican debates, for example, he was basically admitting that the system is based on organized bribery. And he tells all the other candidates, look, I've given money to all you guys at some point. So that's not who the neocons want as their candidate.
So I was talking about this with a previous guest Bay Area guy, and we kind of came to the conclusion that the political ideal would be to combine the best aspects of Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, or better yet, say like Pat Buchanan and Ralph Nader. What are your thoughts on that concept?
Oh, yeah. I mean, a Buchanan-Nader campaign would be great. I don't know if either side would go for that, but I think Ralph might. I don't know if Pat would, but that's not going to happen, obviously. But a Trump Sanders election would be interesting. Trump's economic nationalism and Sanders' more conventional social democracy would be something that's somewhat different from what we normally get. Normally we have two candidates that are representatives of the neoliberal corporate establishment. There's the Clinton dynasty, the Bush dynasty, who essentially have the same basic set of ideas. There's not much difference between any of them. Economic nationalism is definitely a shift from standard brand Republican economics to standard brand supply side ideology. And Sanders is much more serious about his social democratic outlook than any of the conventional Democratic politicians are. So a Trump versus Sanders election would certainly be interesting. And yeah, both sides have some interesting ideas. I'm far more radical than either one of them, obviously. But that would be an interesting contest to watch.
What I thought about is fusionism, combining the best of the views into one candidate. But I think the problem with I'd personally like to see that. But the problem is that people are very rigid in politics. It's like you have to pick a team, and that team adopts this all these positions, or the other team adopts all these positions. So it's very difficult to engage in political fusionism, because then you become politically homeless.
Yeah, and that's something I'm very familiar with. I think actually what would happen, let's say we had an election where Trump is the Republican candidate and Sanders was the Democratic candidate, and I'm by no means predicting that that's going to happen, but let's assume that that happened. I think that would actually have the effect of polarizing American politics even more than it currently is. Like, research shows that the divide between the Democrats and Republicans now is the widest that it's been at any time in about a century. The blue states and the red states and so forth are becoming more and more polarized from each other. And I think a Sanders versus Trump contest would actually have the impact of increasing that degree of polarization. I think the red staters would be more vocally red, and the blue staters would be more vocally blue, because both of those guys come closer to representing the ideal of what both sides say they're for. In some ways, the Sanders is more of closer to being a conventional progressive than Hillary, and Trump is closer to being whatever the red state ideal would be, an economic nationalist or just an old fashioned nationalist or whatever. Than any of the Republicans are. So I think a contest of that type would actually be more polarizing than even conventional politics. Now, as far as a fusionism, I think that's a long way off, and I think that a complete shift is going to have to happen in American politics. I think that conservatism as presently understood is going to have to die out. I think it's going to die out as the older generation dies out. And I think that the in the future, I think the Clinton Obama Democrats are the future of conservatism. Like, in the future, a few decades from now, maybe sooner, conservatism is going to look a lot like the Clinton Obama Democrats today, and perhaps something to the left of that would be quote unquote liberalism. And the question is, what would come after that? I think that's how I tend to look at it.
So. Keith Preston, it has been a great show. I'd like to thank you for being on.
Thanks for having me back.
That's all we have for today's show. So take care. We'll be back with you next time.